Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. Super excited today to have a guest with us. We've had Dr. Thomas Cowan on the show before, and I highly encourage any new listeners to go back on our archive page and listen to those interviews. September 18th of 2017 is when we played our first interview with Dr. Cowan, and that was on his book about the heart, Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. And then about a year after that, October 22nd and 29th, we had a two-part series with Dr. Cowan, and that was on his next book in this three-part series. That book was on autoimmunity and vaccines and childhood illness. And we are excited to have Dr. Cowan here today to talk about the subject of his new book, which the new book's title is Cancer and the New Biology of Water: Why the War on Cancer Has Failed and What That Means for More Effective Prevention and Treatment. So Dr. Cowan, welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, we are really, really excited because you bring such a unique and interesting perspective, as we found out with the book on the heart and childhood illness. I want to start today with a quote from your book that I thought was great. You say, and this is on page 38 of my copy, you say, "Yes, today's physicians can remove a sick gallbladder or a cataract that's hindering a patient's vision, but that is mechanics, not healing. Modern medicine is not only unaware of where and how healing comes about, but is fundamentally antagonistic to even explore the idea." So I'm going to let the listeners kind of percolate a little bit for folks. And I want to do just a quick intro for mostly for new listeners to remind everybody that really we've been under this experiment for the last 70 or 80 years of a pharmaceutical-based and surgical-based approach to medicine and to treating symptoms and disease. And of course, when I got out of conventional medical training in 2002 from UT Houston Medical School, that's all I knew there was. I didn't know there was such a thing as real healing. I thought I was healing people when I was giving them a drug to artificially lower their blood pressure, blood sugar, stomach acid levels, or inflammation in their joints temporarily with a man-made concoction, chemical concoction. And obviously there's maybe a time and a place for rescue medicine and urgent, emergent medicine and surgery. So I'm not talking about that, but chronic diseases that we're seeing an epidemic rise in. I didn't know there were any other options to offer a patient. And for the longtime listeners, obviously, you know, we try to address root causes of disease. And really what we try to do is just set the body's internal terrain, internal environment up for success, set it up to be able to function how it was designed to function by giving it the inputs it needs and avoiding the inputs that it doesn't need or things that impede normal function. So that's a whole new understanding, and it's what kind of a holistic natural medicine approach is, and it's what Dr. Cowan practices. And I just kind of skipped your normal intro, but I think, you know, people, since this is your third time on our show, I do want to mention Dr. Cowan is a practicing physician and has been for a long time, many years. He's in San Francisco now, really specializing in helping people heal through diet and natural medicine techniques. So Dr. Cowan, that was just kind of my little two cents on the matter. And obviously we're going to talk about cancer, but I did want to give you an opportunity to maybe expand on that quote if you want to, but just for the new listeners, because I still run into people. I know you probably get frustrated. I've been preaching for 7 years here in West Texas. Hey guys, there's a different way to do things. And I continually run into people still who are just totally clueless that the pharmaceutical-based approach and it, all these diseases are from our genes and, you know, that kind of thing, victim mentality. So can you just kind of give your perspective on healing and specifically that quote? What do you mean by that and expound a little bit on your philosophy of and why medicine in general or culture is fundamentally antagonistic to even explore the idea of something else?
Okay. So that quote, in a sense, I would say it hints at one of the central points of the book and of the evolution of of my whole career and my whole life, really, in medicine and otherwise. And it turns out, and of course, you know, all this is my opinion, but this didn't start 60, 70 years ago with the advent of pharmaceutical medicine. It started way before that, in the 16, 1700s. And there's an interesting historical reasons why this may have started. But basically, it started with the theory, and I would emphasize it's a theory, and even we even know who actually, like, came up with the theory, which is a guy named René Descartes, a French guy. And he came up with the theory that the human being and actually all living things are simply made of matter and follow the laws of mechanics. That's why I specifically referred to the word mechanics there. Mm-hmm. In other words, any living system is just a collection of molecules in a, well, more or less random pattern following more or less random activities. And he somehow can, and out of that came the theory that the heart is a pump, which it isn't, and we already talked about that, and that basically everything in a human being follows the laws of mechanics. Now, if you fast forward maybe a couple hundred years, and then with the advent of quantum physics, they said, well, when you actually look at this stuff that the human body is made out of, you know, because we're supposedly only stuff, and that's what you learn in medical school, there's only stuff. So stuff is made out of chemicals, which are molecules, which are atoms. So what is an atom? Well, an atom is basically a dot of a nucleus, and then way across the room there's an electron, and 99.9% of it is empty space, right? That's mm-hmm. That's basically physics. And so this collection of stuff that we all believe is the only thing that exists turns out to be just nothing. It's just space. And then if you ask the question, well, how does space become a table, or a leg, or a heart? Nobody knows. And then to make things even more complicated, it turns out that sometimes it's in this form of this stuff, like this atom made out of mostly nothing. But sometimes it's not even that physical. It just acts as a wave. In other words, all atoms, the, quote, stuff we're supposedly made out of, is actually acting and testing as if it's a wave, which isn't even a stuff at all. And then it gets even goofier because it turns out that whether it's a wave or a particle is determined, according to the physicists now, as by whether somebody is looking at it. Right? So we all know this. If you look at it, it's a particle. And if you don't observe it or look at it, it acts as a wave. And then, so, in other words, we're made out of waves. And so how does a wave end up being a body? And then if we're made out of stuff, how does this stuff end up questioning what the stuff is made out of?
Right.
I mean, in other words, we're conscious that we're stuff. But we don't know how consciousness comes about, or a mind comes about, or the question of what we're made out of comes about. Now, to bring this down into terms hopefully your listeners can understand, there's a couple analogies. It's like, let's say you're somebody and you want to understand how the Mona Lisa was painted, right? Some most famous painting maybe of all time. And in a sense, it sort of changed the way that human beings looked at themselves. So it's an important step in the evolution of human consciousness. So we want to know how did this painting get made? But the rules of the game are you're only allowed to examine the paints and the canvas, because that's, after all, what the painting is made out of. And since that's all that exists, so in other words, we're going to try to understand the Mona Lisa as a painting by examining the paint and the quality in the canvas. So you get a microscope and you say, oh, well, this color, it's red, and it was made from ochre of a flea beetle or whatever, and that's why it's such an amazing painting. Or the canvas was, you know, triple threaded canvas linen, you know. And interestingly, it's actually true that Da Vinci, I happen to know this, was very interested in the quality of his paints and the quality of his canvas. But I doubt you can find a single human being alive who would agree that you can understand the Mona Lisa without understanding or even wondering, why did Da Vinci paint it like that? What was in his mind? Because his mind, his consciousness, whatever that is the reason why there's a painting. Now, it's true that without having colors and a canvas, he couldn't have painted it. And another analogy is, if you want to understand a house, like a beautiful house, and you say, wow, that's an amazing house, but all you can investigate is the bricks and the nails and maybe the wood. You're not allowed to say, I wonder why the architect made the bricks into this pattern. Now, the reason I'm saying this is because we have a science, or a so-called science, or one of my favorite sayings is, the trouble with science is it's not very scientific. But we have a so-called science that says, when it comes to a human being, unless you think somehow a human being is less complex than a building or the Mona Lisa, where we already know that this ineffable consciousness of the painter or the architect is basically everything. I'm not saying you don't need bricks, and I'm not saying that the quality of the bricks actually has no impact, because if you have crappy bricks, you're going to have a crappy house, right? So right. You need good bricks. And this is, and we study the human body, the human being, health and disease, but you're not allowed to investigate anything but the stuff that this person is made out of, even if we have no clue what stuff is in the first place. And this actually, I'm sorry to say this, but just because somebody does alternative medicine or so-called functional medicine, I mean, those people, in a sense, drive me even crazier, because they're all about stuff. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, and in a sense, what I wrote this book about is, it's not about the stuff. Not that the stuff isn't relevant, but that's not where the action is. Mm-hmm. And until we figure that out, we're going to have a medical system that's just, you know, it's just mechanics. Yeah. And it doesn't heal, because the healing comes from somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, and that brings me to this next quote in your book. It says, science and medicine is currently practiced in most of the United States and increasingly around the world, is attempting to understand health and disease while shortcutting around the most important consideration of what life is. And it's an impossible task and a bizarre, unfathomable oversight. If we are ever to understand health and disease, I believe we must restore this question to its rightful place as a central concept of an effective medical system. I mean, that just says it right there, everything you've just been talking about. We will continue to get very poor outcomes and be in last place as far as health outcomes go, first place as far as money spent when it comes to health and disease, because of this exact thing that you've pointed out. And I think it was in the book, you also, another analogy I use with my kids, with the carrot and carrot juice, because we have a lady on my staff that juices for us every day. and, you know, bringing that bottle of orange carrot juice home versus a carrot itself. You know, the juice is just the stuff. It's the particles. It's the molecules. It's the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, whatever makes up a carrot. But obviously there's a difference between a whole carrot and that bottle of juice in the jar. And that's kind of, like you said, the essence of this book is looking deeper at what is this thing? So I want you to expound on that too, but I also want to set the stage for the listener, is because we're going to get into cancer. Obviously, that's the name of your book, Cancer and the New Biology of Water. Could you speak briefly on, from the standpoint of cancer, coming at the whole cancer disease, this paradigm of just looking at the human body as stuff and the material, and ignoring that central question that you've elegantly laid out. Can you go through some of those statistics that you talk about in the book? I think it was a German biostatistician that looked at the cancer stats since Nixon declared war on cancer. Can you enlighten our listeners with some of that?
Right. So I started, you know, so why write a book about cancer? I mean, it's in same reason in a way I wrote the other books. Here's the history. In 1971, Nixon announces the war on cancer. He says, we're going to spend whatever we need, and in 10 years, there will be no more cancer in the United States, or at least if there is, we can easily cure it. That was the prediction. I would just point out that the numbers are a little hard to come by, but it's about 1 in 6 people got cancer in 71, and now it's about 1 in 2, 2.5. And the death rate has continued to climb. So apparently it didn't work. Now, the reason why he announced the war on cancer in 71 was because they said, they being the scientists in the medical community, we have now discovered the cause of cancer. So now that we've discovered it, we can fix it. Now, the oncologist won't tell you that they know the cause of cancer because they're a little sheepish about it, I think. But that's what happened in 71 that started this whole thing. So what is the cause of cancer, according to the researchers in 1971 and the doctors? Well, it's very simple. It's oncogenes, or the other word for oncogenes is the somatic mutation theory. And the way that works is if you take a cell, like you draw a circle, a cell has two parts. It has a nucleus and it has a cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is the so-called watery part, and the nucleus is the part that holds the chromosomes. The chromosomes are divided into genes, and every species has a unique set of number of chromosomes. Humans have 46, of which there's 23 pairs. 22 of the pairs are so-called somatic chromosomes, and then there's an X and an X and an X or an X or a Y. So we're not talking about the sex chromosomes, we're talking about the somatic chromosomes. They're divided up into genes, and the theory was cancer comes about because you have a mutation in a gene, and a gene codes for a certain protein, so you get a defective protein, and that causes cancer. In the beginning, they were hoping, thinking/hoping, that everybody with prostate cancer would have the same somatic mutation or oncogene. Everybody with breast cancer would have a different one, pancreatic cancer a different one, or everybody who had prostate cancer, every tumor cell had the same somatic mutation. So it might be different amongst people with prostate cancer, but every cell, every tumor cell, cancer cell that you have is the same. It has this one mutation. So we're going to fix the mutation. We're going to splice it out or give you a correct product that it would have made, and that would solve the cancer problem. So ever since then, that spawned the whole cancer industry and the biotech industry. There's been, you know, I thought there was about $4 trillion spent on, you know, determining oncogenes. My editor talked me down into hundreds of billions, so I don't know which one it is because it's hard to get a number. But probably this one of the biggest projects human beings have ever been involved in has been figuring out which oncogenes are found in which cancer. Unfortunately, or maybe not, that's not the right word, realistically, what they found is the following. Number one, everybody with prostate cancer has different genes that are mutated. So one guy has these 12, one guy has these 160, et cetera. And then if you look at the one guy's prostate cancer tumor, there's thousands of genes, thousands of cells. Cell A has six mutations. Cell B has 6,421. I'm just making up numbers. Cell C has 183. And it's a complete crapshoot. It's very rare that anybody has the same, I mean, people have certain mutations in common, but basically everybody has different mutations. There's no single mutation. And in fact, the keynote address for the annual cardiology's meeting, basically the guy got up and said, if it's oncogenes, we're all screwed because it's so complicated, we'll never be able to do anything about this.
At least he's honest.
That's $5 trillion, or I don't know how many hundreds of billion dollars later. And that's why none of the current therapies, almost like 3%, have anything to do with oncogenes. They're just, you know, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy to kill the tumor, but they don't have anything to do with oncogenes because the whole thing basically hasn't amounted to anything. Now, here's an interesting fact about this. Along the way, you know, people start getting nervous about this whole theory because, you know, it's great for business, but it's not so good for people. So they start investigating what has the effect of chemotherapy been on the survival of cancer patients. So this guy named Ulrich Abel does a study, you know, basically, you know, researches all the published studies on survival and chemotherapy in the early 90s. He comes out with the fact that saying that as a result of chemotherapy, as a result of 20 years of the war on cancer, the improvement in the outcomes for the patients, 2.8%, which is like nothing. And so, you know, he gets criticized and attacked and the usual stuff. So that goes by another 10 years. And so the Australian government decides to do it again. This is all cases of cancer. What can we say about the improvement of survival as a result of chemotherapy? They say 2.1% in Australia, 2.3% in the United States. Or I could have got those backwards, but it's one of those.
2.1 in the U.S., 2.3 in Australia.
Yeah, right. So they do a little better in Australia. Which is like, you got to be kidding. Like, that's nothing. They actually suggested we might want to try something different. Now, along the way, and we can get these references in my book or Seyfried's The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, somebody decides, okay, I'm going to take two cells, a normal cell and a normal cell, and it turns out you can take the nucleus, that's where the oncogenes and the somatic mutations are, and I'm going to put the nucleus of the one into the take the nucleus of the other one out and transplant the nucleus into this cell. So normal cell nucleus into normal cell cytoplasm, and the progeny are normal. Then you take a cancer cell and another normal cell, and you take the normal cell nucleus and put that in the cancer cytoplasm, right? And the progeny are cancer. And then you do the opposite, and you take the cancer nucleus, where the oncogenes are, and you put that in a healthy cytoplasm, and the progeny are healthy. What that tells you, without any doubt at all, is the location of the error in cancer is not even in the nucleus. Not only is it not in the genes, not only is it not oncogenes, not only is it not a somatic mutation, it's not even in the nucleus. It's in the cytoplasm. And interestingly, when you read the papers of the people who do these experiments, who clearly show that the problem is in the cytoplasm, they actually say there must be something in the cytoplasm that can fix the genes, which is ridiculous. They don't know that. They just know that cancer is a genetic thing, must be something in the genes, so must be a healthy cytoplasm can fix the genes. They have no evidence for that. It's ridiculous. Anyways, the analogy that I used in my book was this whole thing is like a guy, imagine a guy, you know, looking for something under a streetlight, right? And you come up to him and you look at the guy and you say, what are you looking for? And he says, I'm looking for my keys. So you help him look for a minute. And then you say, because you can't find him, you say, where'd you lose your keys? He said, over there in the bushes. And you say, well, why are you looking under the street light? He said, because the light's better. And it's true, the light's better, it's easier to look, but you can't find the keys because they're over in the bushes. And the excuse, well, it's thorns over there and it's dark, you know, and there might be a wolf in the bushes or whatever, or a porcupine or skunk. There's more skunks now than there are wolves. But that's not a good reason. The error is in the cytoplasm. And that means the rest of my book was trying to describe, so what is a cytoplasm? And how does that relate to cancer? And how does that relate to life?
All right. Well, we're up against a break, so that's a perfect pause point. We're going to talk about this cytoplasm in relationship to cancer in particular. Before we take the break, do you want to say, and you can say no, but I get this question so often, I kind of would be curious of your, how you respond to patients or the public who ask about the BRCA gene, because it's such a popular in the news and people are getting prophylactic surgeries done, mastectomies and hysterectomies and oophorectomies because of this BRCA gene. What's your take or what's your comment on the BRCA gene, if you have one?
So the first thing is I actually cite studies in the book showing that the prognosis with people with the BRCA gene is no different than people who don't have the BRCA gene. So there's that side of it. A lot of it is overhyped. But the other interesting thing, there are approximately 18 mutations that I think most of us would say actually are associated with either cancer, getting cancer, or worsened prognosis. So most of them are not the usual kind of cancers, but so we're talking maybe 5% total. So the argument is, doesn't that prove that cancer is a genetic disease? So first thing is, that's only about 5% of the total cancer. So what about the other 95%? The other thing is, every one of those 18 mutations that supposedly cause or worsen the prognosis with cancer, the product that they're making has something to do with mitochondrial / cytoplasmic function. In other words, the problem is in the cytoplasm, but some of the products that are coded for by the genes are related to how the cytoplasm will function, right? Just because, like, the cytoplasm is made out of proteins, so the proteins had to come from products coded for by the genes. So if you have a defective mitochondria because you have a defective, gene, it's not a genetic cause, I mean, per se, it's because that particular genetic defect interfered with the function of your cytoplasm. It's like, an analogy, I guess, would be if the architect keeps insisting to put the bricks in backwards, then you could say the problem is the bricks. But really, the problem is with the mind of the architect or the intention of the architect. And essentially what's happening is, in other words, we should just add to the list of things that screw up your cytoplasm, along with, you know, glyphosate and bad food and bad emotions and electromagnetic fields and, you know, aluminum and other things. We should add to that list should be defective gene products. Mm-hmm. So it's just one more thing that can mess up how your cytoplasm functions. Any gene that codes for things not related to, say, mitochondrial or cytoplasmic function won't cause cancer.
Well, that I think is a very good point worth exploring deeper, and we will when we get right back after this break. We're with Dr. Tom Cowan. His book, his new book, Cancer and the New Biology of Water, available everywhere. DrCowansGarden.com. Is that the best website to find you, Dr. Cowan?
There's Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. There's Dr. Cowan's Garden. There's fourfoldhealing.com. The book is on Amazon as well, so anybody can get it any of those places.
Okay, great. Well, y'all stick with us. When we come back, we'll talk more about the cytoplasm, that water inside your cell that appears to be so important when it comes to cancer and health in general. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Dr. Ben Edwards with You're the Cure. Another great episode, a great guest, third-time guest with us, Dr. Tom Cowan, whose new book, Cancer and the New Biology of Water, is an awesome read. I highly recommend all three books, Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, Autoimmunity, Childhood Illness, Autoimmunity, Vaccines, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness was the second book of this trilogy, and then the cancer book. So real quick, recap the first half. We kind of talked about how modern science and medicine is way off track, asking the wrong questions, really. When you ask the wrong questions, you're going to get the wrong answers. And when it comes to health, that means very poor health outcomes. So the war on cancer in 1971, President Nixon declared it, and billions or trillions of dollars later, the statistics are that chemotherapy helps 5-year survival rates. It contributes to the 5-year survival rates 2.1% of the time here in the United States, 2.3% of the time in Australia. Obviously, that's probably not worth the massive amount of diminished quality of life, the damage that's done, the other cancers that are induced by chemotherapy, the suffering, pain and suffering. I doubt is worth the trillions of dollars and the 2% improvement. So the second half of the show, let's move into we point out in the first half, it's not the genes. These oncogenes are associated with or have some role to play, but as we talked about a few minutes ago, the role that they play is they impact the cytoplasm, these genetic mutations that code for proteins that should be performing a vital function in the water of the cell and in the mitochondria. When those genes are mutated, and therefore the proteins that they are making are not functioning properly, it's going to impact your intracellular water. It's going to impact your mitochondria. So Dr. Cowan, real briefly, we don't need to spend a whole lot of time unless you want to. Refresh everyone's memory on this fourth phase of water, structured water, the intracellular water, and then we'll get into its role in cancer.
So, you know, we're taught, I don't remember which grade, maybe fourth grade or third or seventh or whatever, that all matter exists in three phases, solid, liquid, or gas. So if you're talking about water, you're talking about ice, water, and steam. And that's it. It's like a multiple choice question. Now, I remember when I was an ER doctor, when I first was doing medicine, and we were told that 70% of the of the stuff in your cells is water. You can prove that by spectrophotometer. So the question obviously is, so which phase is it in? And so it's not ice and it's not water. I mean, it's not steam, so it must be liquid water. So we were told that all the water in our cells, 70% of the contents of our cells is water, 70% of the molecules. About 99% of the molecules in our body are water, and they're in liquid water because that's all that exists. So then I see all these people, you know, bayoneted and shot and everything, and I never once saw a squirt of water come out of a person or a puddle of water on the, next to their bed. So I even then asked myself, where's the water? And then I thought, well, and eventually as I learned about this, if you think about Jell-O, which is the sort of classic example, Jell-O is not ice and it's not water and it's not steam, and you can bayonet it and nothing squirts out. And it turns out that water, and only water, which is why water is the basis of life, can exist in this previously unrecognized fourth phase, sometimes called easy water or structured water or gel phase water. And all of the water in our cells is in this structured fourth phase water. And if it isn't, you're not doing well. And you can see almost all health problems, like you have arthritis because the gel sac, which is a gelled water called the bursa, and, you know, the cartilage, which is basically structured water, doesn't form properly, and so it deteriorates, and then you have bone on bone and lots of pain. So that's a water problem. If you have a runny nose, your gels have liquefied, and so it's turned to water, which isn't right, and so you get rid of it with sneezing and coughing and all that. You can see almost all the problems that we call diseases as being abnormalities in the structure formation of the water in the cells. And then in particular, if we want, we can talk about how exactly a deterioration in the water structure in the cells literally is the essentially the cause of cancer.
Yes, let's do that, because, and I was going to throw this quote from your book, the thrust of this book is that the structure and the integrity of intracellular water is fundamental to the health of our cells, tissues, and our entire organism. This structure and integrity impacts cell division. It impacts transcription and translation of DNA for protein synthesis, energy generation, and the charge of the cell, along with the receptor mechanism for everything from hormones to neurotransmitters to thoughts and emotions. So, I mean, obviously this intracellular water and the structure and integrity of it impacts all of life. I mean, if you're going to impact cell division and DNA transcription and the charge of the cell and even the cell's ability to receive signals from hormones, neurotransmitters, and even our thoughts and emotions, that's a powerful thought, powerful statement there about this intracellular water. So specifically, how does the nature and the state of that water translate to cancer?
Right. So the way that I try to understand life is by observing and trying to figure out what is unmistakably true about a certain situation. So if you do that with cancer, you know, you can have a lot of theories, but what you experience is a change in the feel of the tissue. The easiest one to describe is breast. So you take a normal breast and it feels a certain way, and then you feel certain way, and then you get to the tumor, and it feels like a kind of a rock or a hard thing in this sort of tissue that's otherwise has a completely different feel. And then when you get away from the tumor, it feels like normal breast tissue again. And the same with prostate or pancreas. And it's that change in the density of the tissue. In other words, the density of the tissue is different. That's what we pick up on scans, ultrasounds, MRIs, CT scans, et cetera. There's a different density of the tissue. So the next question, where does density of the tissue come from? Well, density of the tissue comes because cells have a certain spatial orientation. In other words, they sit next to each other a certain distance apart, not very big, but a certain distance apart, and the liver has a certain distance apart, the eye has a different distance, the foot has a different distance. All the tissues of the body have a different spatial orientation to each cell to the next, and that creates the characteristic feel and density of the tissue. Cancer cells have obviously lost that, and so there's too many cells in the same area. So instead of being, you know, sitting nicely in a row, all one next to the other, they're piled on top of each other. So instead of, just to make up a number, 10 cells per cubic centimeter, there's a million cells or 1,000 cells. In other words, they've lost their spatial orientation. So then the question is, how do cells get a normal spatial orientation? The answer is because cells have a charge. In fact, the electrical charge of the cell is the reason a cell is alive and healthy and doing its function. It has to be charged, otherwise it loses connection to the rest of the cells. So if you can picture this, a cell has, say, a negative charge, like a halo of negative charges around it, and then it meets the next cell that also has the same halo of negative charges, they repel each other and they keep their distance. And that's how the normal spatial orientation arises. Somehow with a cancer cell, they've lost the charge, and so there's nothing to repel, and they pile up on top of each other. So again, where does the charge come from? So interestingly, the answer to that is one of the most fundamental and vexing questions in biology in the last hundreds of years, literally, which is, where does the charge come from? That's essentially the essence of life. And it's aligned with the question of how does a cell live in an environment that's rich in sodium, salt, and low in potassium, yet the inside of the cell is high in potassium and low in salt. How does that happen? And that's been studied for hundreds of years. There's been Nobel Prizes awarded because eventually in the 50s, people figured it out. And it's because there's this pump called the sodium-potassium pump, which pumps the sodium out and pumps the potassium in. And that differential between the sodium-potassium inside and outside creates the charge around the cell, and that creates the spatial orientation. That creates the life of the cell so the cell can do work. And that's fundamental to cellular and human biology. The problem is, and I got this from reading a guy named Gilbert Ling, who is one of the best cell biologists who ever lived. He actually did a very simple experiment where he measured how much energy it would take to do all this pumping of sodium out and potassium in. And he did this over 30 years, and what he discovered was it would take about 30 times the amount of energy to do the pumping as the cell has to do everything. So the analogy is you have a $30,000 a month mortgage on your house, but you make $2,000 a month salary, and it doesn't add up, so you go broke. And there's no way a cell can pump the sodium out using that much energy. The whole sodium-potassium pump thing, which is one of the fundamentals of modern biology, is basically a myth. I mean, there is a pump. It's like a backup generator that doesn't supposed to get used. So the question then is, so if there's no pump, or it's at least not, that's not what happens here, how does this come about? And the answer to that is again, all of the water in the inside the cell is in this mesh-like gel. And when water forms into a perfect gel, it has a certain distance between the molecules, and it has a certain size of mesh. Think like a mosquito netting. And it turns out that the size of the mesh is so constituted by some miracle of nature that just by itself, it attaches to potassium and excludes the sodium, no pump, no energy required. And it's hard for people to wrap their brain around how, I guess you could say, revolutionary that is in science and biology, and how that flips everything on its head. Because then it turns out that the integrity of the mesh is everything. And the integrity of this gel-like mesh is what I meant when you can, if you have a thought, it changes the mesh. And that changes the charge on the cell and changes how it works. It also turns out, I know for a fact, that the DNA, the structure of the DNA, is determined by its being embedded into this gel-like water. And so the thing that determines which part of the DNA will be expressed is not the DNA, but it's the water that surrounds the DNA. And it turns out that cell division, which happens in the cytoplasm, is determined by the integrity of the mesh in the cytoplasm. Now, it even gets into even more interesting, because then you say, well, how does this mesh get formed? And it turns out it's the same way you make Jell-O, because that's also a gel. So you take Jell-O, which is gelatin proteins, you mix, you put it in water, and then nothing happens. So then you add heat, and the heat, it unfolds the proteins so that they can then attach to water, which upon cooling forms the gel. And literally the same thing happens in our cell. We have proteins, probably mostly actin, and there's water, and the actin attaches to the to the water, and then it forms these gels. But the problem is, so where's the heat? What causes these proteins to interact? Because there is no heat. And the answer to that is, it turns out ATP, which is some people describe as the energy molecule, which turns out has nothing to do with energy. But what it does is it binds to the proteins, it unfolds them, and therefore allows them to interact with water and form the gel, which determines the cell division, which is abnormal in cancer. It determines the spatial orientation of the cell, which is abnormal in cancer. And it determines what things influence the cell. It's like a radio. And if it's a goofy gel, then you've got an out-of-tune radio that doesn't pick up the signals. And so then you can see why, if you have an ATP deficiency, i.e. a mitochondrial defect, that will interfere with your ability to form these perfect gels, and then you'll get, you know, wonky cell division and no charge around the cell. You'll get cells collecting with abnormal, you know, chromosomes, which is what we see in cancer, and all lumped up together because they have too high a density, and that's exactly what cancer is.
Okay, so our listeners are pretty familiar with the mitochondria. Would you say that the primary driver of this 1 in 2 or 2.5 people in America now who are going to have cancer, is it rooted in an inefficient mitochondria, therefore not producing enough of this ATP, the heat to make the Jell-O basically? Is it a direct mitochondrial lack of ATP versus, say, a toxin like aluminum that's having a direct impact on the water itself? Or are we destructuring the water itself, or are we damaging our mitochondria, not producing enough ATP to make the structured water, or equal? Would you, in your, what's your thought?
They're both. But so it's, yes. And so I talk about you know, exactly in the book what the role of the mitochondria in not producing energy, and there's also a role of, you know, what kind of water you have in the cells. But here's a very simple experiment that I think everybody should think about as far as how this whole thing comes about. And I got this from Gerald Pollack, who wrote the book The Fourth Phase of Water and is basically the world's water expert. And it's interesting because you can see the whole thing in this one little sort of experiment. Because so whenever you make a gel, it's the gel itself is negatively charged, and therefore there's a separation of charges. Now, if you can imagine, you have a beaker of water, right? And then you suspend a horizontal hydrophilic tube in the water. Just the nature of water and hydrophilic tubes, it will form a very small negatively charged gel layer in the inside of that tube, and that means that the positive ions have been pushed into the water part in the middle of the tube. The positive ions in the middle of the tube repel each other and they start the water flowing. And so you can measure the strength of the gel or the integrity of the gel by two things. One, you can put a voltage meter in the gel and you can see the strength of the voltage. Or two, you can see the flow of the water inside the tube. The stronger the flow, the more robust and healthy the gels are, right? So then you take this beaker of water and you put it in a lead box and the flow stops. Then you take the beaker of water and you shine the sunlight on it and the flow increases. You shine far infrared light on it. The flow increases. You put the beaker of water on the earth, and the electromagnetic field from the earth stimulates the flow to increase. You put your hands on the beaker, and the flow increases. You put, because there's a field effect, an emanation of infrared light and probably other wavelengths from a human being. You put your favorite dog next to it, and it increases the flow. And then you put your cell phone next to the beaker, the flow stops. Why? Because non-native EMF radiation affects directly the ability of water to structure itself as gels. It also interferes with mitochondrial function and any other thing that's associated with life. So you can see anything that interferes with the ability of water to structure itself as gels, if I had to say the number one thing right now, it would be electromagnetic radiation. But there's other things. If, like you say, if the mitochondria don't work properly, you don't make enough ATP, you can't unfold the proteins, that can do it. You dissolve aluminum in the water or glyphosate, that can do it. Anything time you interfere with the gels, you're going to end up with sick people.
Fascinating. It's all about the gel. I think in the book you called it the holy grail of medicine. These things that impact the intracellular water, you know, the things that will give it integrity, which therefore gives you life. We just have a few minutes left. All the things, you know, people want to do things when they have cancer. They want to eat a certain way or take a supplement or whatever. Hopefully, if they read your book, they'll understand they need to have sunlight and human touch and interaction with nature and animals, and non-native EMFs need to be diminished. But you do go through some things in your book as far as supplements and other interventions. We don't have time to go through all of them, but if you were going to give a plug or an encouragement to somebody, are there some that stand out and shine more than others?
I mean, you know, my approach was, given this sort of scheme, you know, and I must say, it may sound a little arrogant, but I was looking for a unified field of medicine. and, you know, whether I found it or not, I'll let other people decide. But, and then I said, okay, well, what about all these things that people have done, like the Gerson therapy and mistletoe therapy and NADH and the Rife machine and everything. And let's look at them from the standpoint of how they interact with the formation of these gels. And it's amazing. I mean, the Gerson diet was, you know, a well-recognized, helpful program for cancer patients. People say it's because you should be vegan, even though Gerson said you have to drink liver juice every day, every 2 hours. But if you actually listen to Gerson and you say, what were you trying to do with this diet? He said, I was trying to restore the sodium-potassium gradient. That's why my criteria for choosing which food or which juices was not carrot juice is good or has enzymes or whatever. It's that it doesn't have any sodium and it's got a lot of potassium. And that's why I gave people all this potassium and told them not to eat celery because celery has too much sodium in it. The whole thing was about restoring the sodium-potassium gradient. And then Rife's thing was how to provide energy to essentially restore the health of the cell. Like, turns out you can add energy to water, and in that itself can restructure the gel. So that's what that was about. Rudolf Steiner was asked, what is this mistletoe therapy for cancer? Probably the most well-studied natural medicine for cancer ever. And he said, well, it heals your etheric body. So what's an etheric body? Etheric body is your water body. So, you know, like, I didn't make this up. I mean, I sort of made it up, but I...
You pulled the curtain back.
Yeah, or something. I mean, this is what everybody who came up with, like, the 10 most popular, you know, what does a ketogenic diet do? It isn't lowering your carbohydrate intake to lower your blood sugar, because it doesn't lower your blood sugar. I know that for a fact. But what it does is it makes you make deuterium-depleted water, which is actual real water that your body can structure better in your cells. I mean, we know that. So that even gives you the actual mechanism of how a ketogenic diet or intermittent fasting actually interfaces with creating healthy gels.
Right.
Once you see that's like the key to the kingdom, then you can start to understand why all these things do or don't work. One of my theses is, if you understand why they do or don't work, you could use them better. And so then I basically give a scheme to help people use them better now that we know what they were really doing.
And can I comment on this? And you can correct me, but because I know I'm going to have a lot of emails and questions on this. The ketogenic diet is good to keep your blood sugar under control and not be hyperglycemic or high blood sugar, but it's not going to lower it to a very low level, like, say, insulin, with insulin-potentiated therapy. People do the keto-potentiated therapy. It's not going to drop blood sugar into the 50s, 40s, 30s, this state of shocking a cancer cell, so to speak. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's not that, you're right, a ketogenic diet will help you not be a diabetic, for sure, and that's a good thing. But, you know, if you test people on a ketogenic diet, or even if you test people who are fasting for 3 days or a week, their blood sugar doesn't go down to 40 or 50.
Right.
And Siegfried was very clear that you have to get people's blood sugar down into the 50s in order to have an effect on killing the cancer cells. Well, that doesn't happen.
Right.
Now, that's not to say it doesn't help, because it does. So there must be some other mechanism. And that's where it becomes sloppy with people. They say, well, it lowers your blood sugar. Well, it does if you're a diabetic, but it doesn't. It just doesn't. And if you don't believe me, just take your blood sugar and prove it.
Right. But it does increase the deuterium-depleted water, which we don't have time to go into that, but the book sure does, and
Some
special healing waters in France. And so some fascinating information in the book, and I'm afraid we're out of time. But I encourage everybody, get the book, Cancer and the New Biology of Water, by Thomas Cowan, available on Amazon. Again, Dr. Cowan's website's humanheartcosmicheart.com, which I also highly recommend that book for anyone with heart disease or heart disease in the family or just curious about the truth about heart disease. DrCowan'sGarden.com, fourfoldhealing.com. Your places to find Dr. Cowan. And I believe you'll be speaking at the Weston A. Price Foundation 20th Annual Conference in Dallas coming up soon.
Yes, I will. And I hear you're going to be there too, so I would love to meet you when we go there.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. As always, great interview, great information, such a wonderful perspective on health and life, and really appreciate you, Dr. Cowan, and all your work and sacrifices over the years. I know you've had to walk through some hard things, I'm sure, to speak the truth. So thanks for all you're doing, and encourage everyone to check out his websites and check out the book, and we'll have to have you back again someday.
Okay, thanks a lot, Ben. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.